I call this meeting of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee to order. It's Monday, March 23rd, and we have a quorum present. First, a reminder about our committee rules. Signs are not permitted in the committee room. Verbal outbursts, shouting, applause, or other disruptions are not allowed. Sitting or standing in the aisle is not permitted, and the State Patrol and House Security staff are present to ensure everyone's safety. If you leave the committee room, please hang on to your tickets to re-enter the room. And we have a very full agenda today, so we'll be limiting all the testimony to 2 minutes. Thank you all for your attention and participation in this committee's work. Our first order of business is approval of the minutes. We have two sets of minutes to approve today. First is the minutes from the 1 p.m. hearing on Wednesday, March 18th. Representative Hewitt, would you move to approve the minutes?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Representative Hewitt moves approval of the minutes. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes from 1 p.m. Wednesday, March 18th are approved. Next, we have the minutes from the 5 p.m. hearing on Wednesday, March 18th. Representative DePell, would you move approval of the minutes?
So moved.
Representative DePell moves approval of the minutes. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes from 5 p.m. Wednesday, March 18th are approved. The first bill on the agenda today is House File 4438 from Chair Bierman. Chair Bierman, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to move House File 4438.
Chair Bierman moves that House File 4438 be recommended to be placed on the general register. Chair Bierman, I understand that you have a DE1 author's amendment. Would you explain and move your amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move the DE1. The DE1 has a number of technical updates from MDH to ensure critical public health programs are run efficiently and without disruption. Supporting stronger collaboration across public health partners and streamlining outdated reporting requirements to provide clarity and public health information. So that would be the DE1. There are some specifics I can speak to as well. For instance, Section 1 permits Palliative Care Advisory Council to provide reports to the legislature every other year. Section 2 and 3 combines two separate suicide prevention reports into a single biennial report. Section 4 and 5 is a federal conformity issue, aligning Minnesota statutes with federal guidance. This is for WIC, and this will improve service continuity for families relying on nutrition benefits. Section 6 addresses the State Community Health Services Advisory Committee by allowing tribal governments to participate in state public health advisory committees. This will strengthen our partnership across the state and improve statewide public health. Section 7 to 9 are cleanup of statutory language for audiology and speech language pathology updates. And that is the exciting high points of this bill.
Thank you, Chair Bierman. Chair Bierman moves adoption of the DE1 amendment. Any discussion? Representative Nadell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just one question, Representative Bierman, is are we changing, so like I'll just use SNAP and WIC, we're moving to being exempt from, you know, speedy contracting 16C. Is this typical for SNAP and WIC, or is this something new?
I have Ms. Timian here, Madam Chair. I have Ms. Timian here. I'll have her do a deeper dive on that for you. All right.
Ms. Timian.
Thank you.
Yep. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lisa Timian. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the Minnesota Department of Health. So, yes, to your question, Representative Nadeau, this is really just it's essentially still a five-year contract, but then can be extended up to 10 years. So there's still the same amount of like program integrity and our ability to make changes if needed or if we see an issue. We haven't seen issues in this problem with the WIC program and how it's administered, but this should just make it easier for the counties and community health boards to administer this program at the local level to have the steady technology that is needed.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Nadeau.
Thank you.
Chair Backer.
Thank you, Chair. Madam Chair, so with the WIC program stuff, what does that mean to the end user and to the businesses that provide that? What will that mean if we make this change?
Ms. Timian. Chair Bierman.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Chair Backer, so this is really, it should make everything more technologically efficient for everyone involved, just because they have this continuity of a technology contract that all their systems can meet, you know, speak with, and all that. So it should be an easier system for everyone to use.
Chair Backer.
So right now, if the counties cannot communicate right now, go ahead.
Ms. Timian.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Chair Backer, this is really just, this is an update to the current practice that instead of it's a five-year contract cycle, now it would be a five-year contract cycle with the ability to renew for an up to 10 years on this, just so that allows a little bit more time with the program itself without needing to update.
Okay, thank you.
Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor of adopting the DE1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. We'll now move to testifiers. No testifiers. We have done what needs to be done. Closing comments.
Good bill. Hope you will vote for the...
I'm sorry. Discussion to the bill.
Yes.
Silly me. Vice Chair Nadell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Bierman. A couple of weeks ago, and this has to do with the reports that we require our agencies to submit to us, and because this bill is a lot about reports, there was a bill a few weeks ago, and it had to do with the Community Clinic Health Grant report. And I was looking for those reports for the bill, and I was informed by the Legislative Reference Library that in 2023, that was listed under a report that the department no longer wanted to provide. And it's the Health Legislative Report Sunsets Bill that the committee never voted on, but the agencies have decided to enact those and decide when and where they want to kind of submit those reports. So I would love to have Lisa talk about the reports and if these will be sunsetted without the legislature making that decision, and if that will be included in some other bill at some point in time.
Chair Bierman or Ms. Timian?
Madam Chair, Representative Nadeau. So your question was to the Legislative Sunsets Report. So that was from 2021. There was new ability for agencies to identify reports that didn't meet certain conditions so they could be sunset. MDH has not identified reports to be sunset in the last 2 or 3 years at this point, so we have not submitted any reports for sunset. So at this point, we're still producing all the reports, to my understanding, that we are required to be producing. If you're finding that that's not the case, though, I'd be happy to talk to you about that.
Vice Chair Nadeau.
And thank you. And I'm looking at the sunset report document right now. Suicide Prevention Plan Progress Report, Statewide Health Improvement Program, Tobacco Use Prevention, Vulnerable Adult Maltreatment. And so, like I say, the bill that was in 23 was never acted on by the committee, but the agencies have apparently decided that they're going to sunset these. And I just want to make sure that these reports in Representative Bierman's bill are not going to be sunset by the agency without coming back to the legislature. That's my question.
Chair Bierman, Ms. Timian.
Madam Chair, Representative Nadeau. Yeah, so our intention with this is just to make sure that we have a little bit more clarity with some of the reports that we do provide for you all. To the question of the 2023, I would have to go back to look at that as well to see if we missed something or if we're not implementing something correctly. But I will look at the language from the 2023 session and get back to you on that question for reports.
Thank you, Ms. Timian. You can get that back to committee administrator, please. Vice Chair Nadeau?
I'm done, thank you.
Okay. And Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thank you. And I can maybe shed a little bit more light or maybe more confusion on the issue. I'm not sure which.
No more confusion.
But there was legislation passed some years ago. I don't know if it was 21, but it actually there's sort of an automatic sunsetting of reports if they're not continued. So in other words, there was an effort to, you know, we pass reports into law and then they just continue forever, or this is how it used to be, even if no one ever used them, looked at them, cared about them. And so I think in an effort to make reports be more meaningful, if we're spending money on them as a state, they should be useful for somebody. There's sort of a piece of statute somewhere that sunsets them automatically, but I think there's a report that comes out first to tell us what will be sunset so that we can object to that. And I guess I would just ask House Research, maybe not this second, but maybe in the future, to make us all aware of that, because I have frankly lost track of that a little bit, and I do occasionally wonder whether a report that I'm interested in is still going to be produced. So I think it is a useful point that you're bringing up, a helpful one, Representative Nadeau, and I think we should be aware of these, but I don't think it's, in my memory, it's not the agency deciding that a report should, it happens by operation of law unless we object to it. So I just would ask House Research maybe to make note of that and kind of advise us at some point so that we can all kind of have it top of mind. Thank you.
Vice Chair Nadeau.
And thank you, Representative Liebling. And it's Section 144.05 Subdivision 7 is the statute that requires the sunsetted reports report. And the reason I know this is because, like I say, I tried to look at the community clinic health grants, and the last few years there was COVID. There was a lot of reports that weren't generated during COVID. I think we all understand and accept that. But, you know, when they're not sunset, and community health grant reports, for example, the library sent a number of notifications to the agency, but they never did receive those reports. And so that's where I was trying to have this conversation. There are some of us that actually, you know, really do read these reports and try to be informed as we make these decisions. And I just don't, and maybe I need to work on 144, you know, 0.05 and make sure that that's where it is. But I just want to make sure that, you know, the work that we're doing here today and we're asking the agencies to perform is actually coming back and informing us in our legislative process. So thank you for indulging me.
Thank you. Seeing no further discussion, Chair Bierman, closing comments.
Thank you, members, for the discussion, and thank you, Representative Nadeau, specifically for that comment on the prevention reports as far as suicide goes. That's something I want to make sure we're getting the reports. And with violence prevention, specifically gun violence prevention, that's an incredibly important report that we need to expand and develop, not restrict or stop. So we'll need to make sure that one's coming through. That's it. Thank you very much. Hope to continue your support on this bill as we move forward, and more feedback is always welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Bierman. Chair Bierman renews the motion that House File 4438, as amended, be recommended to be placed on the general register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed?
Nay.
The motion prevails, and House File 4438 is amended, is recommended to be placed on the general register. The next bill on the agenda today is House File 4467. Chair Bierman, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, please. I would like to move House File 4467, please.
Chair Bierman moves that House File 4467 be recommended to be placed on the general register. Chair Backer, I understand you have an A1 author's amendment. Would you explain and move your amendment?
Not this one. Yeah, Karma, I have that. Yeah. It's on this one here. Okay. I was like, okay, cool. Yes, I got the amendment. Okay. Well, yes, I would, Madam Chair, I would like to move that amendment. Yes, ma'am.
Chair Backer, could you please explain your amendment?
Yeah, basically last year in 2025, there was a court case, the Supreme Court case, that ruled that counties have the right to do their own, in essence, MCO program, okay, a managed care type of organization that we call CARMA. Before they had that, it was county-based purchasing. and that was passed. And what this does, it puts in line, this amendment puts in line to that court case. Specifically, the amendment modifies current law related to the commissioner's discretion regarding offering other plans in county-based purchasing who are administering CARMA, and provides for enrollment for CARMA after MA eligibility is met. That does not supersede that. The individuals will still have to meet that in regards with anything set forth by the federal government, like HR 1 and so forth. So those eligibilities, excuse me, needs to be determined and verified. So passing this amendment aligns us with the court case that was decided in both the district court and the Supreme Court to give counties that flexibility. The courts recognize that counties have that legal authority, and it lines up to that court case.
Thank you, Chair Backer. Chair Backer moves adoption of the A1 amendment. Any discussion? Chair Bierman, any comments?
This is a friendly amendment, and recommend the committee accept it.
Thank you. Any additional discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. We'll now move to testifiers, and we have Christy Grown, Director of... I'm sorry. Boy, I am off my game today. Would you care to introduce your bill?
No, Madam Chair, I don't care to introduce the bill. I think it'd be easier if I just introduce our first testifier and go to Ms. Crown for a clear definition. It's a cleanup technical bill from DHS.
Thank you, Chair Bierman. Ms. Grum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Christy Grum with the Department of Human Services. So this is the annual policy bill from the Healthcare Administration. There are five main components of the bill. It's fairly straightforward and looks a little bit longer than what it actually is because there are portions of it that contain a recodification. So I wanted to flag that at the outset, and I'll tell you more about that as I walk through the bill. There are, I believe, summaries and indexes in your packets for you to follow along. So walking through the summary, the first main component of the bill is related to Minnesota Care. We have some technical and clarifying changes, the first of which is related to federal conformity to a new federal rule that's applicable to Medicaid as well as to CHIP and the basic health program. So this is a rule that was published in 2024. States had about 12 months to get into compliance, and DHS in the state of Minnesota is now in compliance as of this past June. So the specific change that you'll see in section 15 or 16, is that there's a removal of a requirement for a Minnesota Care enrollee to pay a past due grace month premium as a condition of re-enrollment. So this is just conforming with that federal rule and making sure that our statutes are up to date with that. And that is section 16, just to clarify. The next two changes in section 15 related to Minnesota Care technical updates. One is related to incorrect citation, where the Minnesota Care statute is cross-referencing the wrong enrollees who are exempt from paying a premium. So this just corrects that. And then there's a change to update to clarify that someone can be eligible for Minnesota Care, but they may not have coverage, and that's in section 15 as well. The next big bucket of changes is related to medical assistance for employed people with disabilities. This is a technical change. So MAEPD is a program that helps people with disabilities to buy into medical assistance when their incomes might otherwise be over that. And their premiums are based on their incomes. There is a requirement in statute that if people don't pay their premiums, DHS needs to deny or terminate those unless they meet a good cause exemption for the lack of payment. And good cause is defined as an excuse for the enrollee's failure to pay, and it goes on. And we get about 1 to 3 requests a month from people that who have not failed to pay, but they've already paid, and they're requesting a good cause exemption and asking us to refund. And that's not what the law lays out. That's what the courts and administrative judges have upheld for us, but we continue to get these requests. So this is just clarifying that that a good cause exemption is not granted if someone has paid the premium. The next change is in Section 16, and it's related to a report that we are doing for the legislature, a pilot that was established related to long-acting injectables. So these are injectable medications for antipsychotic disorders, and this is work that's come out of the Priority Admissions Task Force and Priority Admissions Panel to try to address how can we better support people who are in correctional facilities at the local level to get to the right bed and the right therapeutic bed that they need, whether that's at a state-operated program or another community program. So the legislature administered funding that is goes through this fiscal year, so this June, end of this June, and this pilot is ongoing. There's a lot of work happening where we're disseminating funding to counties and tribes to be able to figure out how can they use that funding to get these medications and treat people and have better outcomes. So we're in the process of doing that, but the legislative report was actually due this past December. So this proposal would move that to November 30th, 2026, so that we can report once we have the full pilot completed and let you all know how it goes and what the recommendations may be for ongoing funding for that kind of support for people in correctional facilities. The second to last provision is in Section 11. This relates to physician oversight in outpatient settings. So this provision removes requirements in law that conflict with newly required guidance from CMS, as well as federal law that's been adopted that provides tribal providers the authority to render services outside of the four walls of a clinic on the condition that the services are provided under the direction of a licensed physician. So right now, state statute has a higher bar and requires two physicians and some other requirements, which is not the federal requirement and is a little bit outdated as we think about the evolution of outpatient services in the past decade or so. And then this making this change to align with federal law, make sure that tribes are able to get the encounter rate outside of those four walls. So just aligning with federal law with this provision. And then the last changes are the main substantive change is in Section 7, but it actually covers Sections 1 through 9. This is where there's a recodification that I mentioned. So nonpartisan staff in the House and the Senate and the Revisor's Office got together, identified that 256B04 Subdivision 21, which is a provider enrollment statute, was messy, hard to understand, and needed to be recodified. So they went ahead and did that, and I think there's legislation moving in the other body to that effect. To make things easier, because we were amending that statute in this proposal, we just included the recodification. So most of the language that looks like it's new is not new, but the new language that I want to point your attention to is in Section 7. And that new language gives DHS the explicit authority to disenroll Medicaid providers if they haven't billed in the past 12 months. We've already been doing this as a program integrity measure to make sure that people that are billing are in the program and providers that aren't billing are not and would have to re-enroll if they wanted to start billing again. But we just wanted to make sure we had that very clear in state law. And that, Madam Chair, is the bill.
Thank you, Ms. Grum. Are there any other members of the public wishing to testify? Seeing none, any discussion of the bill? Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Rep. Bierman. I would like to ask a question regarding on Section 7, which starts at 12.4. Can you explain to me, when I look at these subdivisions, there's only one place you say must, and in Subdivision 1, Subdivision 2, Subdivision 4, the word may is there. And I ask that question because in healthcare, I'm very used to the words shall and must when we're talking about, especially something that this is related to fraud. So I am very concerned seeing the word may, because may is what got us in this problem, the word may, because there wasn't a must stop payment, a shall stop payment when you have concerns. So can you walk me through and help me understand how the word may makes any sense in Subdivision 1, 2, and 4?
Ms. Grum.
Madam Chair, Representative Zalesnikar, this is not new language. This is current law. This is just moving current law into a new section. If the legislature wanted to make something wanted to make this mandatory and not permissive, happy to have that discussion. I'm very open. We're very open to having that discussion with you.
Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you. I am very interested in that. I think the word may is the commissioner may suspend the provider's ability to bill until the provider comes into compliance. The commissioner may revoke the enrollment of an ordering or rendering provider when they fail to maintain and to access documentation. And the commissioner may terminate the enrollment of an individual who has not submitted any claims in previous 12 consecutive calendar. I just think it's problematic to not see the word must when there is clear indications that there's a significant issue. I would like to see that considered for the record to be amended as we move forward. Thank you.
Any additional discussion? Seeing none. Chair Bierman, closing comments.
Thank you, Representative Zalesnikar, for that. And we should talk more after this. And as it moves forward, we can consider and itemize and discuss those issues. Good update. Thank you for the clear and concise overview. Good bill, and happy to see this move forward.
Thank you, Chair Bierman. Chair Bierman renews the motion that House File 4467 as amended be recommended to be placed on the general register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails, and House File 4467 as amended is recommended to be placed on the general register. The next bill on the agenda today is House File 4379. Chair Bierman, would you like to move your bill before the committee?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to move House File 4379 before the committee.
Chair Bierman moves House File 4379 before the committee to be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Chair Bierman, I understand you have the A1 amendment. Would you explain and move your amendment?
Yeah, the A1, members, is some technical language and clarification. It's pretty clear, I think, just changing some of the terms and definitions.
Thank you. Chair Bierman moves adoption of the A1 amendment. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. I see you also have the A3 amendment. Would you explain and move your amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the A3 helps two of our rural CCBHCs by updating these two clinics' rate rebasing timelines starting calendar year 2026 as their base years. The amendment language also deletes some old obsolete language from a similar update we made in 2024 for two different clinics. And that's the amendment.
Thank you. Chair Bierman moves adoption of the A3 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Chair Bierman, to your bill as amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, House File 4379 is a proposal that seeks to strengthen our children's mental health service continuum and remove barriers to accessing intensive mental health models to address the ongoing crisis of children boarding in hospitals, detention, and with counties. House File 4379 is a policy-only proposal that codifies the Early Childhood Mental Health Consultation Grant as part of our continued work to increase transparency and accountability with grant making. It eliminates barriers for highly acute children to be cared for in appropriate settings. It builds further alignment across community-based mental health. It allows direct access to skills training to support children and their families with mental health symptoms. And it updates the Youth Act. This is language to expand impact of this team-based service that helps children with acute mental health needs stay in the community. My testifier, Madam Chair, will provide some more context for these proposals and anticipated impacts, and hope we can go to Ms. Brown next.
Thank you, Chair Bierman. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Hi, my name is Shannon Brown. Co-chairs Bierman, Backer, and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 4379. I am the CEO of Fernbrook Family Center and the board chair of Aspire Minnesota. We're grateful to this committee for your support to develop the children's mental health continuum in this time where needs continue to exceed capacity. We continue to see children boarding in hospitals and detention centers because the services they need do not exist or they do not have capacity to serve them. These are children who need more than 1 hour a week of psychotherapy at an outpatient office. These are children who need intense skills training 12 plus hours per week. They're children who need expansive wraparound services like Youth Act. They may be able to avoid boarding later in life by accessing services available through the Early Childhood Mental Health Consultation Grant. The Early Childhood Grant allows us to get kids into services sooner. It reduces barriers for families, and it provides consultation to child care providers who are caring for these kids daily. These services work. Fernbrook has countless success stories, and I'll share one with you today. We had a 12-year-old client who came to us for stabilization after boarding in a hospital for over 3 weeks. Caregiver was a single mother with three other children at home, and this child had assaulted her and one of the younger children. He was urinating in bedrooms throughout the house at night, damaging property, running away from school. He had experienced a traumatic brain injury as a child, therefore had complex medical needs. No one knew what to do with him, but staying in the hospital was not the answer. We were able to find a residential treatment center placement for him that could keep him and his family safe, provide intensive services to address his medical and mental health needs, and create stabilization. After successful discharge from this placement, he is now receiving skills training. His caregiver is receiving family skills training. He's back in school. He and his support team are learning the skills they need to keep him in his home and community. Serving these kids is complex and requires a team of professionals. The language in this bill will expand the kinds of professionals who are able to contribute to the valuable team-based care of Youth Act and will allow these teams to deliver care to the age range that they are competent with. These services are a crucial part of building a mental health system that keeps children in their home and community while treating their mental health conditions and supporting the caregivers who care for them every day. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the public who cares to testify? All right, any discussion to the bill? Chair Backer.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for Madam Chair. And thank you, Chair Bierman. So my question is number one, it seems like it creates a new activity, but obviously there's no money appropriated. So what's our goal for this bill? I mean, what is the outcome? Or, help me clarify, help clarify that to us. What's the end in mind specifically?
Chair Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is an infrastructure bill, essentially. It's creating the services that should be taken into account for the children and identify their needs with coordinated care teams. I think it's modeling the school-linked mental health grants program and sort of aligning for that. But this is an area of our mental health continuum that has been not fully built out. And that's my understanding, but I would like Ms. Brown to follow up and answer her more in-depth.
Ms. Brown.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. That's exactly, these are services that already exist. A lot of this is just codifying things in statute to make it clear and consistent across providers to make sure things like reporting and how the grant is operationalized for the early childhood grant is done. And then with Youth Act, it's just clarifying the infrastructure and how the teams are built and what qualifications they need.
Chair Backer.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that, but when I look into the language, it seems like this bill gives the commissioner the authority to define the quality of the program and their outcome. That's what it seems to me from the language, and you know that's concerning. If I'm in error, just like my wife reminds me that I'm in error a lot, just let me know. But that's when I look at it, it seems like we want better outcome, but that's going to be decided by the commissioner. We want to give more activities, but we're not going to give any more money. So can someone help me through that a little bit, please?
Chair Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First off, Chair Becker, I would like to meet your wife and have a conversation.
Thank you. She probably would too.
So,
just so I can talk to your wife too, okay?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
That's for sure. In all seriousness, you know, the commissioner is the head of the agency. So, I mean, it's a lot of things are done in the name of the commissioner, and obviously she would be the one who's overseeing the whole enterprise. But I think, as was mentioned by Ms. Brown, this is like going through the needs of what this continuum should have in establishing in statute the way a program should operate if someone is going to apply for and receive a grant for the purposes of addressing the children's mental health service continuum that we need to have, and that we need to make sure is accessible, and that we need to make sure is appropriate for the care level needed from the top down, from leaving a hospital all the way down to local counselors. So I see it more as just not that we're creating a bigger thing than not paying for it yet. I see it as putting that infrastructure in place, identifying the needs that kids are going to have and the professionals that we need to oversee it.
No further question.
Anything you have to add?
No, thank you.
Vice Chair Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Bierman. On 8.26, that paragraph, it's in section 5, and we're changing three to two or more individuals and individual or group skills training. Are these, I'm assuming that the clients we're serving here have ratios, and how is that going to impact, you know, providers? How will this change impact providers in the way that they deal with the ratios? And if there's no ratios in this population, my question is moot.
Chair Bierman.
Ms. Brown, you want to describe that? I think I have ideas, but
yep.
Let's go right
yep.
to the sources.
Ms. Brown, please train. Proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are you asking for 8.27 if there are required ratios that we have to have for that program? So this would set a minimum requirement. There are maximum requirements that are outlined later where it says for group skills, you can after a certain number, I can't remember what it is, that you have to have, after 10, you have to add a second provider. What this would do is especially help temporarily when if a client discharges, maybe they have to go to a higher level of care all of a sudden. By changing it from three to two, that allows us to continue to provide that service and bill as we would have, so that for provider's sake, to help with consistency, it just lowers that threshold because this population can be inconsistent because of the level of care changing regularly to having to go to higher level of care or maybe discharging successfully to a lower level of care. It creates a little bit more flexibility.
Vice Chair Nadeau.
And thank you, Madam Chair. So, but these are still provided in units, correct?
Correct.
So it's not going to have a negative impact from a finance impact or a positive. Okay, thank you. And my next question is on line 11.18. This language used to be written that the provider entity must deliver the service components of children's therapeutic services, and now we're saying it's just one. Can you talk to me? I mean, I'm trying to think of where this would apply and how, and I can't figure it out.
Ms. Brown.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So previously we had to provide, it was expected that we provided psychotherapy and skills training, and in order to provide skills training, you were supposed to also have psychotherapy. But this gives flexibility to the licensed mental health professionals to determine which services are of clinical importance and which ones are necessary. Where there are times when psychotherapy is not an appropriate fit, especially at that time. There are times that a client needs to learn the skills during skills training before they can truly do the work of psychotherapy. And so this gives us the flexibility to make that determination as licensed mental health professionals when they receive the services and in what combination at what time.
Vice Chair Nadeau.
You're not limited by that now. I mean, you don't have to provide, I mean, you still have that autonomy and that flexibility And maybe it's just we're just cleaning this up for the practice. Is that what it is?
Okay. Ms. Brown.
Correct. That's what it's just cleaning it up and making that clear because based on how you read it, sometimes there was open to interpretation whether or not that was required, and so this just cleans that up.
Okay. And my
Vice Chair Nadeau.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. My final question has to do with this with the rights of minor children in Section 4. This is new language, and as far as I can tell. And can you walk me through the rationale for this? And you know, as I look at like starting on 8.14, you know, those restriction of rights. I mean, I think about, and I'm not trying to be punitive here, but you know, part of, you know, my understanding and talking with providers, there's consequences to, you know, certain behaviors. And I'm wondering if this is, even though I think it makes me feel good, I wonder if this is something that should be in statute where we're prohibiting providers and licensed folks from doing certain things. And I'm wondering the value of that.
Ms. Brown.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think what this comes from is the desire to have the ability to operate with prudent parenting, where the providers are able to, you know, give bedtimes and determine like frequency of meals, recognizing that children should not be able to make those decisions independently, and the adults and providers that are responsible for them have the ability to put some of that structure in place and make sure that all kids are getting all of their needs met.
Thank you. Seeing no further discussion, Chair Bierman, closing comments.
Members, we all know the issue of boarding going on with children, and this is just an added piece to work to solve that dilemma across the state and address the needs in our continuum of care for mental health, and hope to have your support on it.
Chair Bierman renews the motion that House File 4379 be laid over for possible inclusion. The bill is laid over. So, members, we have six bills to go, and I do want to get all questions answered. And so I understand we could come back after session if needed. Otherwise, I hope we can just move quickly through the rest of the agenda. Thank you. Next up on the agenda, House File 4349 from Chair Bierman. Chair Bierman, would you like to move your bill before the committee?
Yes, Madam Chair. This is House File 4349. I would like to move that before the committee.
Chair Bierman moves House File 4349 before the committee to be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Chair Bierman, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, gene therapy represents an extraordinary advancement in the promise of curative treatments for rare diseases. Diseases that were once fatal are now disease course altering and even curable, such as spinal muscular atrophy. The state of Minnesota has been a pioneer in this field. We conducted some of the largest clinical trials in some of these gene therapies, and at one point we were the only state in the U.S. offering gene therapy for a fatal rare disease called MLD, metachromatic leukodystrophy. The current bundled payment reimbursement system did not anticipate one-time curative treatments that offset years of healthcare costs for a chronic disease. DRGs, the diagnostic-related groups, are an inadequate reimbursement model for these treatments, innovative treatments. The original bill that passed in 2024 aligned our reimbursement structures for cell and gene therapy by allowing the treatment to be reimbursed separately from the associated costs of delivery in the DRG. The language modification you see here in House File 4349 provides flexibility by allowing the use of value-based arrangements without making them a prerequisite for unbundling. This would allow DHS to use VBAs on disease populations when the complex data collection and outcomes identification is feasible, and using other methodologies for patient populations for whom VBAs are not feasible. That's the bill. And
Thank
asking
you.
For the committee's assistance to make this adjustment in the bill from 2024 so that we can have more options in order to seek applications and the ability to deliver these innovative therapies as they come. So would invite, I don't have any testifiers right away, but if members have questions that want to go deep on this, we have people in the audience who can come up.
Thank you, Chair Bierman. And are there, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Sorry, we will be hearing your bill after this is related, so we can continue the conversation.
Any members of the public wishing to testify? Seeing none, discussion, Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Bierman. I remember when we passed this underlying language, and I have a couple questions on this. It's, you know, I know enough to be dangerous on this stuff with the pharmaceuticals, and I know that there's a lot of ins and outs to this. 340B, of course, being one big complicator to all of this. And I'm wondering a couple things. One is, do we need a fiscal note for it? Is there a fiscal note in process? And the second question just would be, on this last line of the bill, hospitals must be paid the actual acquisition cost. I think we're talking here about public programs, and so if the hospital acquires it through 340B, and I don't even know if that's possible for these kinds of products, but the acquisition cost could be extremely low if it was obtained through 340B, I think. And what would that mean for this, that they would get the very low acquisition cost repaid to them, or, you know, how would that work?
That's a good question. I think I will invite Ms. Barnes up for that one. I haven't, I've been following this and looking at other options as far as this whole, the whole landscape of these purchases for gene therapies across the country, but the 340B question I have not seen yet relating to these rare disease products.
For the record, Chair Liebling, a fiscal note has been requested. And Ms. Barnes.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, yes, so this is all very new, of course. As you know, these gene therapies are just coming on the market, and there's lots of conversations around the reimbursement rates. As I know currently, the 340B program is not being applied to these yet, although that's definitely something I think that the legislature needs to be considering as you have your whole conversations around 340B and the program. The rationale behind the actual acquisition cost is to make sure that these are reimbursed for adequately for the hospitals, and then potentially so that they are not being reimbursed for the purchase low and then reimbursed high as well. So trying to just put some parity and equity in the way that they're reimbursed.
Chair Liebling.
Thank you. Thank you for that. That's very helpful. And so the other thing is, are these some of the patients, in fact, many of these patients will be patients through managed care right now. And so how does that work with patients who are, you know, insurance company paid patients and not direct pay from the state?
Yes.
Ms. Barnes. Or
no, you go.
Chair Bierman.
So excited. okay, maybe. Madam Chair and Representative Liebling, so this particular bill applies to fee-for-service, particularly for the unbundling and for managed care. I believe that those are the managed care, those that are doing the managed care are doing all of the reimbursement through the companies that are doing the managed care, not through DHS.
Madam Chair, I would just also add that there are states that are doing this a little differently, and even if there's an MCO involved, they are carving out these high-priced drugs and using fee-for-service applicability both in Michigan, Indiana. There's a lot of different ways states are tackling this issue in very diverse ways, though.
Chair Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry, I don't mean to take up a lot of time here, Chair Bierman, but I'm just kind of confused. So if somebody is, so this only is meant to apply to the 15% of our patients who are on fee-for-service. So the other 85%, if someone with a rare, comes down with a rare disease and they're a managed care patient and they need one of these therapies, what's the situation? Might it be like not covered, or how will it be paid for?
Chair Bierman.
I think in Minnesota they would be a managed care patient and insurance would be covering for that.
Okay, I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Nadeau, briefly, please.
Yeah, thank you. Well, I'm going to pick it up from there because this is, you know, this is the implementation of this is where I'm questioning as well, and also the rebates. I mean, these are drugs that have massive, massive rebates. And, you know, so all of a sudden you have a hospital that's going to share in that, you know, and that rebate exchange, and now they're being limited to the actual acquisition cost of a particular drug. Now, I understand hospitals don't want to lose money. That's perfectly great. But, I mean, I think they're, and I'm glad that we've requested a fiscal note because, I mean, this is going to, I mean, the rebates on gene therapies are massive. And I do believe that they're currently, CMS has already listed these drugs in the 340B program. And I don't see where, you know, that could severely complicate this. And actually, if you've got a patient on an MCO and they come in with a gene therapy, you've got to figure out a way for that MCO to carve out that treatment, you know, whatever it is, and then DHS is going to pay the drug, the acquisition cost, and then not pay the MCO. I mean, there's some stuff here that's very confusing. I'm not sure this one's ready for me, but.
Chair Bierman.
Madam Chair and Representative Nadeau, this one is a work in progress for sure. And, you know, we need to continue to work with DHS, which is what, you know, we've been trying to do the last couple of years. We need to have some movement in this area, though. And so we need to, I think, as a legislature, push a little harder because this bill, you mentioned the high cost of this patient care. One thing I'll note is that with the fiscal note that came out before, there were some questions about how many people it actually included. And when you look at the projections of who this would apply to as far as numbers of patients, the number is very small still, but it is a growing market and field as new things are coming online and new discoveries and research and applications. So the number of patients that we would see, while small, will be growing soon, and this bill has an outsized impact on the state's ability to deliver these treatments and remain competitive in the field.
Chair Bierman, any additional closing comments?
No, just thank you, members, for your attention, and as we continue to work on this with both the department, with the Rare Disease Advisory Council, and all of you, I hope to move this forward. Thank you.
Chair Bierman renews the motion that House File 4349 be laid over for possible inclusion, and the bill is laid over. That's the end of the bills from Chair Bierman, so I'll return the gavel.
All right, next bill on the agenda today is Senate File 3402 from Representative Viernig. Welcome to the committee, Representative Viernig, and I will move Senate File 3402 to be recommended to be placed on the general register. Representative Viernig, to your bill, please.
Thank you, Chair Bierman, Chair Backer, and members of the committee. Before you is Senate File 3402, a bill brought forward by local public health to address challenges in hiring a statutorily mandated medical consultant. Minnesota Statute 145A.02 requires a community health board to contract with an employee, to contract or employ a physician to provide advice and information, authorize medical procedures, and assist in coordinating activities with local medical practitioners and institutions. This bill expands the medical consultant role to include other prescribing providers, such as advanced practice registered nurses and nurse practitioners, or physician's assistants, and aligns with local public health medical consultant role with language in 245F.02, which defines a medical director in withdrawal management programs to permit a wider list of eligible providers. And I do have a testifier with me today.
Thank you, Representative Vernig. We will move to the testifier. If you could just introduce yourself to the committee and proceed with your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Co-Chair Bierman and members of the committee. My name is Lisa Brodsky. I am the public health director for Scott County and a member of the local public health association. And I am here to speak in support of this bill on behalf of our members. And thank you to Representative Vernig for her leadership on this bill. While this proposal may appear technical, the impact at the local level is very real. Across both metro and rural communities, the challenge is not the willingness to comply with the statute, it's the availability. Community health boards are required to secure a physician to serve as a medical consultant, but in today's workforce environment, physicians are really stretched thin. In many areas, there are simply not enough to meet these needs. In one rural southwestern Minnesota community, the health department lost its medical consultant to retirement and has been unable to recruit a replacement due to severe provider shortage. In my own county, our medical director, who also serves multiple other counties in this role, will be retiring soon, creating a significant gap in the metro. These are not isolated situations, and they create uncertainty for planning and service delivery. The medical consultant plays a key advisory role, providing clinical guidance on immunizations, consulting on communicable disease response, and advising on maternal and child health. These responsibilities require clinical expertise, but not necessarily a physician specifically. Advanced practice providers and physician assistants already deliver frontline care in our communities and are well qualified to provide this level of consultation. This change ensures that statutory requirements do not unintentionally limit our ability to provide timely services and offer a practical solution that reflects today's healthcare workforce. Thank you for your consideration, and I am happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Brodsky. Any other members of the public wishing to testify? Seeing none, discussion to the bill members. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you. I feel like I'm the only one asking questions, and I apologize, members. But so are we running out of positions to be able to sit on these as consultants on these boards? Is that the problem, that we need to expand the eligibility to other healthcare professionals?
Ms. Pratsky.
I think that there is a lot of competing pressures on physicians between their clinical care, their hospital care, so they're being pulled in multiple different directions, particularly in greater Minnesota as well. They just have a lack of providers that are available.
Follow up, Representative Nadeau.
No, thank you.
Co-Chair Becker.
Yeah, thank you. So my question is, are we now taking a risk of having non-MDs on the board? Is that opening up a different Pandora's box?
Ms. Brodsky.
Thank you. I would say we're aligning with withdrawal management programs, which have a much higher risk than public health departments. Typically, how we utilize our medical directors to sign standing orders that come down to us from the Department of Health, and also make recommendations for communicable disease response, which is also utilizing the guidance of the Department of Health. This really just aligns with withdrawal management programs. When our first medical consultant law came into play, that was in 1977 with the Community Health Service Act, and that was prior to us even having a certification for advanced practice nurses. So it really is just bringing this language to what is the reality of the market today and what is available.
Follow-up? Chair Backer?
No follow-up, no. Co-chair.
Seeing no other members, Representative Vernick, closing comments.
Yes, thank you, chairs and committee members. Supporting this bill is another step closer to addressing the shortage, particularly in rural communities, and expanding the pool of eligible individuals to work with their local health departments in this crucial role. So I appreciate any support you can lend. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Vernick. I renew the motion Senate File 3402 be recommended to be placed on the general register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say no.
No.
The motion prevails and 3402 is recommended to be placed on the general register. Thank you, Representative Vernick. Now we will go to House File 4064, Vice Chair Ryer. Vice Chair Ryer, I move your bill to the committee, and please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Bierman, Chair Backer, and members. When we think of healthcare, most of us probably think about our clinics and hospitals and all the providers that give us the care we need. But in Minnesota, we can also take pride in the expertise that brings forward medical advances, providing treatment options for previously untreatable conditions. We have world-renowned researchers for rare diseases such as ALD and ALS at the University of Minnesota Fairview, Mayo, Health Partners, Hennepin Healthcare. We have excellent clinicians, including care for children at Children's Hospital in Gillette. We have a robust and active Rare Disease Advisory Council that serves as a model for other RDACs around the country. And we have advanced technology like that at the Hormel Institute, which continues to innovate and lead on using technology to address our healthcare needs. However, as one of the many letters in your packet notes, the problem isn't any single gap. It's the entire journey from lab to patient. We have all these pieces, and the feasibility study proposed in this bill will help us assess our system as a whole and determine the potential to strengthen our system through the combined efforts of the private, academic, government, and nonprofit sectors. Specifically for this bill, Subdivision 1 recognizes Minnesota's leadership in biomedical research and healthcare innovation, and recognizes the importance of fostering scientific progress and promoting economic development in gene and cell therapy. Subdivision 2 states that it's the policy of the state of Minnesota to support advancements in cell and gene therapy, including research and development, workforce training, public-private partnerships, among other aspects. Subdivision 3 provides some definitions, and Subdivision 4 is the core of the bill. It requires a feasibility study that addresses this question of what is our actual capacity to become the leader that we want to be and what would it take to get there? It includes all parts of the cell and gene therapy ecosystem in Minnesota. Finally, Subdivision 5 requires a report that includes recommendations and identification of potential federal, public, private, and grant funding to support implementation. I believe that Minnesota could be a top center for healthcare innovation in the United States and internationally. House File 4064 is an important step to move forward, and I ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair Ryer. We will move to testifiers, and one is in place. If you would like to go ahead and introduce yourself to the committee and proceed with your testimony, please.
Thank you. My name is Dr. George Aslanidi. I'm professor at Hormel Institute, University of Minnesota, and I work in the field of gene therapies for over 25 years, both development of those therapeutics as also addressing issue with the productions of those therapeutics. One thing what strikes the most, those patients who identify with rare genetic disease and their family is the lack of cure and lack of hope. What they have. There's about 7,000 genetic diseases, and only a few of them have treatable options like a gene therapy. The concept of the gene therapy is well developed right now, and there's several products available on the market for spinal muscular atrophy, for hemophilia or Duchenne muscular dystrophies, but this is not enough. Minnesota as a state has unique ecosystem, including University of Minnesota, Hormel Institute, Mayo Clinic, many small colleges and companies were developing those novel cures. However, there's a gap in a centralized program with gluing together all those discoveries, and especially there's a gap in production capabilities, what exists on the East Coast and the West Coast, but not available in the middle of the country, and especially in Minnesota. So this bill will provide is very important support for feasibility study to understand how this ecosystem can function together and how to increase production capabilities in the state of Minnesota, and eventually how to provide better cure to our patient, not only in the state, but beyond the state.
Thank you, Dr. Aslanidi. Next testifier is on is virtual, and Dr. Lambert, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
We can hear you well, Dr. Lambert. Please introduce yourself to the committee and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Laura Lambert. I'm a biomedical scientist at Mayo Clinic. I work on developing gene therapies for patients with rare genetic diseases, many of whom have no existing treatment options. I'm here today in support of HF 4064. Behind every rare disease is a patient, often a child, and a family searching for answers. In many cases, they are told there's nothing that can be done. But today, that's starting to change. We now have technologies like gene therapy and genome editing that can directly target the root cause of disease. I have seen these advances move from concept to real possibility, but I've also seen how difficult it is to turn that possibility into something a patient can actually receive. Developing a therapy is only one piece of the challenge. Delivering it safely, navigating regulatory pathways, building the right infrastructure, and ensuring equitable access all require coordination across research, clinical care, and policy. This bill takes a necessary step back to evaluate where Minnesota stands today and where we need to go. It will help identify gaps in capacity, workforce, and systems, and create a roadmap to move these therapies from the lab to the patients who need them. This bill is important because it asks a simple but critical question. How do we make sure these breakthroughs reach patients? By evaluating Minnesota's current capabilities and identifying gaps, this study will help build a path forward so that hope doesn't stop at the lab, but reaches the patients and families who are waiting. I urge your support of HF 4064. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Lambert, for your testimony. Any other members of the public wishing to testify today? Seeing none, we'll move to bill discussion. And Co-Chair Backer.
Yeah, thank you. And, you know, I understand, you know, we want to do everything we can to help folks with any type of disease. But at the same time, we have limited resources. My question is are we going approve? Does this set us up to approve for therapy that we do not know that will work? So we're spending, you know, tremendous amount of money on reimbursements, but we don't have the data. It seems like that we may be putting ourselves in that position that we don't have that data that the treatment may work. Address that, please. Go on, Vice Chair Ryer.
Vice Chair Ryer.
Thank you, Chair Bierman, Chair Backer. Actually, I think one of the beauties of this bill is that we take a leadership but not a sole role in getting the map and seeing what's out there and seeing what's feasible. But it in no way implies or is intended to imply that we are going to be the agent of doing that. That's why the business community is supporting it. That's why academics are involved in it. It's because all of these people have the resources and the will to do this, but we don't know what it'll take to make a coherent system, and this is getting us there. But I think you're right to raise that risk. I don't think that it's one that this bill takes us to.
Chair Becker.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, and that's why we have that discussion here, because that is my concern. We only have X amount of dollars, and we want to be able to help those people with that type of scenario. with the rare disease, but having the will, and if I want to go to California but I head east, it might not be the best scenario. So I just want to caution us to make sure we use our limited resources to actually provide that. And that's my, and I know this has work, it's just being laid over. I want to share with you what my concerns are and so forth, so we can, it's easy to use other people's money. That's what I'm concerned about.
Vice Chair Iyer, perhaps Dr. Aslanidi would like to weigh in on this.
Yes, thank you, Chairman. What I want to say is that there's many good discoveries what happening at University of Minnesota and Hormel Institute and Mayo Clinic and around the country. Those rare diseases often cannot receive a cure because big companies, they are not interested in a smaller market. So the academic involvement is extremely important for those particular diseases. And proofs of the concept were done on a preclinical model often showed efficacy, but next step to have first clinical trial is practically impossible because of many regulatory, finance, and other obstacles. And one of the obstacles is the production of those capabilities in a small batches what allow to test in a human. And only human clinical trial can answer a question if there will be working actually in the patients.
No further follow-up.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Aslanidi, for that comment. Chair Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Ryer, for bringing this. I think it's, I just want to make a couple comments. I support the idea for sure because Minnesota has been a leader in all kinds of medical research. This is one of our strengths as a state. It's been a big part of our economy, and hopefully it will continue to be. We have people flocking to this state from all over the world for the treatments that we provide. So it's really important to continue that leadership. And we're at a time when the federal government is turning its back on research. And so normally I'm a little bit skeptical because in the past, historically, we as a state don't have the resources to do the research and we don't have the eyes on the whole system that the NIH would have, the National Institutes of Health. And so I was always a little skeptical of we as a state trying to put our foot into the basic research funding field because of that. But we're in a different situation now where the federal government is absolutely turning its back. And so it's good to do what you're doing here, proposing, to take a look at the system and ask the question, how might we, should we be stepping into this? Where are the gaps and what is our role going to be? So I fully support that. I did just want to comment that subdivisions 1 and 2, we normally do not put into legislation things like legislative intent and state policy is, and I'm a little uncomfortable with that, I want to say. So I hope that as the bill moves forward, you'll take those out. We just don't do that. But I support the intention of the bill, and glad you're bringing this forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. Next would be Representative Keita.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for this bill. I have a couple questions. When we involve academia, there's also the IRB process anytime that we do research. I've been concerned about the IRB processes in general, especially like when I look at lines 3.2 of this bill. It states that there wants to be partnerships with rural and underserved communities, which tend to mean that we're going to look at tribal communities in some capacity. How do the universities or the academic entities involved incorporate the tribal IRB process in something like this, more than just your own IRB process in this?
Vice Chair Iyer, would you like to take that, or do you want Dr. Aslanidi, if he has
Dr.
a thought on it?
I have a perspective.
I can give some perspective.
Please, Dr. Aslanidi.
So the robust system of IRB what exists at the University of Minnesota and in Mayo Clinic is addressing all these issues and fully, in my understanding, comply with state and federal regulations. It's simple as it is. I cannot speak up for the chair of our IRB committee, but I know it. One of the issues is constantly raised up For example, in few weeks back, in the Ethics Week was conducted by university, particularly working IRB was issued as the most important.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Breyer.
Thank you, and thank you for your question, Representative Keeler. For me, I think your concern is well taken, and we're not going into this saying there's going to be a study with an IRB. What this is it's an item within the scope of the work that needs to be done to say how are these equity issues being addressed, and I'm happy to clarify by specifying including through the IRB process, because this is all about discovery, and hopefully we can take that offline and discuss in a way that can address the needs that you're expressing.
Follow up, Chair Representative Breyer? Or Keeler, sorry.
Thanks. I would like to follow up, because that's the problem that we have with the U, is that the U thinks that their IRB process is in compliance, and it's not. The tribal IRB is a totally separate, like, compliance process that we have to go down. And so I would like to talk about it more offline, because I think it is important that we need to outline that those partnerships have to happen when we're leaning into underserved communities. We can't just assume that the U is taking all of that into consideration. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Keeler. And the bill is being laid over, so we have further work we can do on that. Representative Van Binsbergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Breyer, I'm just curious, you know, as we're looking at this, again, I'm concerned about cost, and I know this bill's being laid over, but this is going to mandate a new study, basically. Do you have any idea? Is this $1 million deal or $2 million deal? Has there been any research done on what this study's going to cost the state?
Vice Chair Iyer.
We have a fiscal note requested, and I'll let you know as soon as I know.
It does seem to me that it would be helpful that we knew these costs before we started having discussions like this. That'd be my opinion. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Van Binsbergen. Having fiscal costs is a perennial problem in the 8 years I've been up here, and they do come eventually, but we need to get the bills in order and hear them as they come, and so we can follow up. This bill's being laid over.
I agree, but mm-hmm. I still say it is helpful before we hear bills that we know what
understand.
Cost.
All right, that is complete. So, final comments, Representative Breyer.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, members. This work is going to happen. It's going to happen somewhere. Other states are doing this and have hubs that are economic engines. They're economic engines for intellectual capital, for research, for manufacturing, for good jobs, good community development. And I think we would be remiss if we don't take advantage of the opportunity to explore whether we have all the pieces in place and need the glue, or if we are so far out of range that we shouldn't make those investments. And this is intended to give us clarity around either of those things. So I hope that as we move forward, we take this seriously, take this opportunity, and invest in our state. Thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair Iyer. Vice Chair Iyer renews the motion. House File 4064 be laid over for possible inclusion. And the bill is laid over. Next up, House File 84, Representative Hewitt. Would you like
Chair,
to move your...
Sure, is that the order we're taking them in? We have three of them. I thought we were going to do the other one first.
Oh, sorry.
I believe it's...
Representative Hewitt, we'll start with House File 3804.
Yes, sir.
Would you like to move your bill before the committee?
Mr. Chair, I would, and I'm hoping it'll be possibly laid over for inclusion.
Thank you, Representative Hewitt. Two-year bill.
So, members, this was part of a bill that we passed last year in the state of Minnesota to allow individuals to choose natural organic reduction. We found that there were some flaws within the bill that would make it hard to actually offer this service right now. Most of it has to do with how long you can keep a non-embalmed body in refrigeration. I was really grateful to Chair Liebling as I was coming in to get ready for this hearing today to point out something that's flawed in actually the writing of this bill. She pointed out that a body kept after the 30 days must be embalmed, which actually can't happen because you have to embalm a body within 6 days. But that's I'm willing to work on that with the chair to make sure we get that language cleaned up. But basically what this allows is for 30 days, the body can be not embalmed. And what we're finding in the NOR, I call it a project, is that most of the people that request this are farmers. They want to be returned to the soil that they've been planting for years. And throughout the country, we're seeing more and more of this go to rural areas. And it's cremation only in a natural aspect. For our small funeral homes to put in what we call retorts, it would be really expensive, like almost $200,000 to put these in, whereas in this space, they can actually do it for probably around $25,000, and they can offer it to their people without having to go into the metro area to have this done. So this is what I bring before you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hewitt. Any members of the public wishing to testify? Seeing none, discussion to the bill. Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hewitt. So I'm a little bit unclear then. What was the motion on this bill?
The bill will be laid over for possible inclusion.
Oh, okay. That's great. And because, so thank you. And thank you for working with me, Representative Hewitt, on that. And I didn't even know about that rule about how soon you have to embalm a body. I mean, I just didn't know. But what occurred to me when I read this was just if you were someone who asked for natural organic reduction, this bill is saying that if they hold your body too long, you have to be embalmed, which for that person would probably be like the last thing they wanted. So in its current form, it's kind of problematic, but thank you. I appreciate what you're trying to do, the underlying sentiment of the bill. So thank you.
No further questions. Closing comments, Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for hearing the bill. Thank you, Chair Liebling, for pointing that out to me. And I know more about this industry than I care to. Anybody that would like to take this over,
no, thank you.
One once or twice. So, we have a number of funeral directors that I was able to phone a friend on this situation, and they're still here in the room. So, I think this is great to help us get to the phases that we want our citizens to the requests they're making. So, wonderful.
Representative Hewitt renews the motion, House File 3804, to be laid over for possible inclusion, and the bill is laid over. Now we'll go to House File 84.
85.
House File 84. Representative Hewitt, would you like to move your bill before the committee?
I would, and I also request that this bill be laid over.
Very good. Representative Hewitt moves the bill before the committee for possible inclusion. Representative Hewitt, to your bill, please.
This is another area that we need to look at. Again, we're trying to do a lot with the funeral industry. We're one of only four states that require a four-year degree right now to be a funeral director. This is something I really look forward to in the future of us looking at again. Most funeral directors throughout the country are technically trained, and as embalming becomes a past practice, most people are now cremated or use other options to go into the ground or whatever. I don't want to get too graphic on this, but the funeral director's roles have changed, and what we're finding, the U of M is one of the few schools in the country that has a four-year program. I think at the time when we put that program in place, it was great, but now we need to look at other options here for training. They come out of the U of M with a fairly hefty debt, and we're not desirable to do their training here, and so What we're asking simply is another licensing pact with other neighboring states, and I believe even Chair Backer's on the bill. I think out in those areas in the rural Minnesota, again, we're having trouble getting staff. So this would help us recognize another license from another state and tell the department that we would accept that license.
Thank you, Representative Hewitt. No testifiers. Any other members of the public wishing to testify? Seeing none. Discussion to the bill. Chair Becker.
Yeah, Minnesota is an outlier for this because we make it so more difficult for people to go in this business in Minnesota. So I support this bill. Where we're at, a lot of our folks, when they pass away, they're working with folks in South Dakota because, number one, it's cheaper, and number two, it's easier to find folks. So supply and demand, it's the supply still there, but it's that cost. We don't make Minnesota more in line with the other states. So I've had extensive conversations with folks out west in my area and other areas that Minnesota is just way, way difficult. And quite frankly, it's not a fun business to go into. You know, you're almost like an EMT. When you're on call, you're always on call. But here, they don't have other people to take call. You're on call. When they come, there are some very, it's a challenging business working with individuals. And then we just make it so much more difficult for people to get into this business and for them to attract folks from other states to be a mortician. They're raising the cost. Our community had a funeral home and they had closed because they couldn't find a mortician to even share with other neck of the woods. So I like the bill. Thank you, Representative Hewitt.
Representative Chair Liebling.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair, and thanks again, Representative Hewitt, for handling these difficult issues. I have really mixed feelings about this bill because I wonder if, people who are already licensed in Minnesota, are they going to feel like we're undermining them by letting in people who have less training and suddenly, I wonder if this needs a bigger fix. And, it kind of made me think about maybe we need different levels of licensure. Maybe to do the embalming, maybe you need that degree. But we have a school of mortuary science here at the university, and I just wonder if we're undermining our school, But on the other hand, I do not believe in requiring, this almost goes back to our discussion on the massage bill, to require all kinds of education that's not really relevant to what you're going to be doing in a profession. We don't want to do that either. Mm-hmm. So I have really mixed feelings about doing this. And I could you just discuss, and sorry if I missed it, like who supports this and who's weighed in on it or could be weighing in on it that maybe doesn't know about it?
Mr.
Representative
Chair,
Hewitt.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and Chair Liebling. Great question, and you know what? It's above my pay grade, but I do have phone a friend. So I'm going to ask the president of the Minnesota Funeral Association to come on up. I believe he's from Washburn McGreevy, and he speaks for the industry. So. I hope I called the right person.
Thank you for being here. If you would just take your seat and introduce yourself to the committee, please, and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jordan McCreevy-Seitz. I'm the president of the Minnesota Funeral Directors Association, which represents more than 650 licensed funeral directors and over 250 licensed funeral establishments. I want to thank Representative Hewitt for his work on House File 84. Minnesota's funeral profession, like so many others, is facing a workforce challenge. Funeral homes across the state are struggling to recruit licensed morticians as we seek to attract funeral directors from other states. Our reciprocal licensing requirements presents a significant barrier. As mentioned, Minnesota is one of four states in the country that requires a bachelor's degree to practice mortuary science. An out-of-state mortician seeking a reciprocal license must also meet this requirement. The result is that experienced licensed morticians from nearly every other state are effectively shut out of practicing in Minnesota. House File 84 addresses this by creating an alternative pathway within the reciprocal licensing process. Specifically, the bill allows an out-of-state mortician to qualify by demonstrating at least 3 years of practice in another jurisdiction with documented completion of 25 embalmings, 25 arrangements, and 25 services. The applicant must also pass the required examinations, complete continuing education, and submit an affidavit for confirming that they are not subject to any pending investigations or practice under a restricted license in another state. Essentially, this bill is not a shortcut. This bill maintains strong standards and consumer protections. It simply recognizes the years of on-hand experience in another state that should count for something when we are asking qualified professionals to come to Minnesota. MFDA believes this bill strikes the right balance between maintaining high standards and addressing the workforce needs in our profession.
Representative Liebling, did you get the answer you were seeking?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not really. I was kind of looking through the questionnaire that we have in our packet, too. But so could the testifier, like, you represent a lot of morticians and a lot of the establishments. Are there a lot of, how many morticians are not represented by your organization?
Mr. McCreevy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Liebling. In regards to amount, we represent about 60%, so there's about 40% throughout the state that aren't represented by our association.
Chair Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, you know, I guess I continue to have mixed feelings about this. I think a larger reform is probably needed. I mean, I recognize that it is difficult to have the workforce shortages, but I wonder if we pass this, it almost encourages someone to, instead of starting their career in Minnesota, to move out of state, work for 3 years and then come back. And I really don't like that idea. I mean, if we're requiring too much of people here in Minnesota, we should take care of that, not set up our Minnesotans to have to compete with people who come in with an easier time into the profession and then come across the border and work here. I don't know. I feel like I don't have as much information as I need about what the impact of this would be, but it's being laid over, so it could still be discussed. So thank you, Representative Hewitt. Thank you, the testifier. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hewitt, did you have a comment?
No, I think okay. I think the chair's hitting the right areas.
I'll move to Representative Vice Chair Nadeau.
I'll pass, thank you.
Pass. Representative Van Binsbergen.
Just comment. Thank you, Representative Hewitt, for carrying this bill. We carried something similar last session on for CPAs and accountants, and this kind of falls into that line of thinking, and I appreciate that. I live in central Minnesota. I see the shortage of what's going on there. This is clearly going to fill a void, and, you know, I'm a believer in this is going to create a little more competition, and maybe there'll be some new people, more people that will get involved in the industry, and I believe that's a good thing. You know, our overall arching goal should be to make Minnesota more affordable and for our residents. And this is clearly one way to do so. I thank you for the bill.
Closing comments, Representative Hugh.
No, and I thank you, Mr. Chair, for considering this. We'll hear more in the next bill that comes up about some of the what's going on in the industry, but I appreciate you laying this over.
Representative Hewitt renews the motion that House File 84 be laid over for possible inclusion, and the bill is laid over. We'll move on to House File 85. Representative Hewitt, would you like to move your bill before the committee?
I would, Mr. Chair, and another bill to be laid over.
Representative Hewitt inclusion. Moves House File 85 before the committee to be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus. Representative Hewitt, two-year bill.
This bill is actually how we get people to the area of mortuary science. Now, I think there was some misintended things that happened in the House last year, like we did the transfer care specialist, but then we found out they can't go in the prep room, which another bill for another day, like Representative Liebling was doing. That was not intended that way. Prep rooms are nothing but surgical suites, and even I, as an EMT, went into surgical suites. So I really have a lot of trouble with this, but in this bill, once somebody becomes an intern, they have to, in Minnesota, they have to complete their test, have to complete their schooling, and then they can be an intern. This really is not a good situation, because what we're finding is even people that are going to mortuary science once they get in the prep room, are leaving because they found out this is not what they want to do. I'm not saying the prep room is the ultimate pivot point for this, but there are so many things in the funeral industry that they really should dive into before they get into the profession. It is a big commitment. I remember when I was looking at it personally, I worked as a night attendant, and all I did was I vacuumed 10 yards of carpet every night. But it was a good feeling, and then when I went out and picked up people in the middle of the night, I understood it. But for some reason, interns right now, they have to go through their schooling and take their tests to get there, and all this does is once they get in their program, they actually can start working in a funeral home and working under the direction directly under a funeral director. I think this is a very simple, straightforward bill, and this does answer to people that are interested in the industry and gives them a real look at what it is. But what I don't want is somebody getting to their third year in college and going, this is not really what I want to do, and they end up in nursing, which has happened to many of these people graduating from our four-year program. So back to you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hewitt. Any members of the public wishing to testify? Seeing none, members, discussion? Seeing none. Thank you. Chair Liebling.
Thank you. Sorry, Representative Bierman. Sorry, Representative Hewitt. I also have some concern about this. And first of all, though, I want to say that from this, I was reminded that, in fact, mortuary science graduates do have an internship requirement, which is just over a year, which is really interesting, and no one's complaining about that. So, you know, in some other fields, people are complaining about having to, do a sort of a working in the field under supervision for a little while, but here they're not, which is really interesting to me. But it seems like, first of all, a question maybe to your testifier, don't mortuary science students do some clinicals during their training, during their four-year college required training? Don't they go in a prep room and see what embalming is?
Mr. McCreevy.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. Thank you, Representative. Yes, they do clinicals. The University of Minnesota, they do a variation of different clinicals, one being a three-week straight clinical, one being a one day per week for a semester clinical. So they're getting about 126 hours of clinical hours per clinical rotation that they're doing. The overall internship in Minnesota is 1,280 hours. So there's substantial more amount of experience that they're allowed to get through the internship. And then we do have some variations with external colleges that do supply clinical rotation cards that are accepted here in Minnesota. And there's more opportunity for experience because of the length of those clinicals for external state colleges. So our clinicals are a good piece to it. The clinicals themselves, I did raise this question to the head of the mortuary science program at the University of Minnesota. Would this do away with clinicals? Short answer is likely yes, because they're already gaining the same experience if we proceeded with this.
Chair Liebling.
Okay, thanks, Mr. Chair. And so, okay, I'm not sure I understood that last piece, but so as I look at the bill, what sort of the main thing this seems to be doing is that, or one of the things, I'm looking at like line 2.31. So it allows them to essentially start practicing under supervision without having done the coursework for that. So it kind of really does relate to the last bill we heard, because it really kind of raises a question of what kind of education do they need and what are they getting, because it almost looks like an apprenticeship then, that they're learning by apprenticeship, which may not be a bad thing at all, but then it does kind of call into question why, what is that coursework for if you can do the actual practice before you get the coursework relating to that? I don't know, that just doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And again, I think this all calls for sort of a larger rethinking of what is needed here and what the education is that these folks are getting and what they actually need to get. So
Chair Bierman.
Representative Hewitt.
I believe Chair Liebling is trying to make my life rougher. digging into this more. I think you're hitting it right on. We saw this in EMS. We saw this in many places, and this is one of the areas that it's probably best that I keep attacking it, not attacking it, but to making it to the times, right? I don't think there's anything wrong with an associate medical degree from the program at the U because they teach, they get into more grieving work now. I went and witnessed a few classes where I think they could, there's something more that can become of that degree also. But as this industry changes, like many industries in our state, we need to make, if you're gonna go into this, you really gotta know what this is. And that's what the lobbyist brought to me is, you know, this is what's hurting us right now because they get in the prep room and then they find out, well, I really don't want to do this, or they work at 2 a.m. and find out they really don't want to do this. And so this gives them maybe what, like Mr. McGreevy was talking about, the internship where the clinicals used to be, now they can start that earlier and get involved with the mortician more and what they're doing. It just kind of is a stepping stone. But I am with you 100% on this. Talk about an industry that we need to change a few things, and I don't think the industry's fighting it either. They all see it, and I think us as a legislature have not given the department the tools they need because they're limited to what we have, and then they got to put stuff in rules, which is going to be a whole other thing for another year, hopefully. But we're trying to do bits and pieces that we can keep people alive and working in the industry that they thought they wanted to go in, and this is one of those steps. So I always appreciate you and your interrogation of me, and you were a great chair when I was a vice chair. So I think that these are great questions, and yes, we have to do a lot more in this industry.
Thank you. Representative Liebling, you're good? All right. Seeing no other members, closing comments, or was that your closing comment?
Mr. Chair, I think I'm done.
You're done. Very good. Representative Hewitt renews the motion, House File 84, to be laid over for possible inclusion, and the bill is laid over. And we, as a committee, are complete and adjourned.